During the Second World War, German planes dropped 32,000 tons of bombs on British cities.
Black and white footage of German planes dropping bombs.
From Clydebank to Coventry, Liverpool to London, in an 8-month onslaught known as the Blitz. The resilience shown by the British people in the face of this horror would become known as Blitz spirit. It's often held up as a sort of benchmark of Britishness, something we can call upon in times of crisis. But I think it's important to understand just how much of this is really true.
Nearly every street had a house in flames. Dead and dying on the pavements. Frantic parents searching for their young.
Through the experiences of six real people, I'm going to show you what living through the Blitz was really like.
It was really heartbreaking. No sooner would fire be got under than it would be hit and start again.
And they're going to tell you their stories in their own words.
I had absolute conviction that my number would be on one of those bombs.
In a national crisis.
Water! More water!
They volunteered for roles that would put them on the front line of a bloody and terrifying war.
We crouched in doorways thinking, the next one must get us.
And it would cost some of them their lives. Blitz spirit is only part of the story. I want to show you why we remember what we do and what's been left out. Because this chapter in our history has never been more worthy of a closer look.
A figure dashes through darkened ruins, then smoke reveals the words Blitz spirit with Lucy Worsley. Wearing a dark beige skirt and cream top, Lucy's slowly walking past row after row of metal shelving.
The bombing of British cities during World War II was a defining moment for the country. 80 years on, it still resonates profoundly.
We talked the whole time about Blitz spirit and keeping calm and carrying on, as if these things define us. But they've become clichés. I want to look again at the experiences of real, ordinary people living in extraordinary times. After all, our archives are full of them.
He looked as though half of London was sleeping, and 50,000 firemen
could
and saw and heard the anti-air.
The press proclaimed the public were
unsure. We've been hit. One in a million.
This is the diary of a 17-year-old Jewish girl called Nina Maisel from Romford.
In September 1939, she was working in her parents' shop in Essex.
In a general way, I was horrified by the prospect of war.
And the worldwide suffering it would bring. In a particular and personal way, I was hoping and hoping it would happen. War, for me, was the single force strong enough to release me from the dull predictability of my daily life. Hence, too, a feeling of excitement rather than apprehension on the morning which we were expecting the announcement of war.
To withdraw their troops from Poland.
On the other side of London, in Chelsea, Frances Faviol, a socialite and artist, was living with her husband Richard.
That no such undertaking has been received. And that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
Richard comforts Francis.
You may be taking your part in the fighting services, or as a volunteer in one of the branches of civil defense. If so, you will report for duty in accordance with the instructions you receive. You may be engaged in work.
Seemed extraordinary that one could listen over the air on a perfect summer day to such
world-shaking events.
Must have been strange in the 1914 to 18 war to have had no radio. In fact, rely on couriers and war correspondents' dispatches for news. Now, people would await the BBC News Bulletin with such eagerness and apprehension.
And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage.
In 1939, when Germany invaded Poland and Britain declared war, it was clear that this time it wouldn't be fought in faraway trenches. This war was coming home.
And everybody knew that this time it would be different. War would bring unprecedented terror from the skies.
In the years since World War I, there had been huge advances in military technology. Government experts predicted that in 2 months, bombs and poison gas dropped from planes could kill 500,000 civilians. The government's biggest fear was that people would panic and a collapse in morale would force a surrender.
I think that the people in power looked at ordinary people, about whom most politicians knew very little, actually, in a new light. They realised that any chance of winning the war depended upon the ordinary people of Britain keeping their nerve. So how do you prepare a nation for death, for devastation, for disruption on an unprecedented scale? Their answer was civil defence.
The idea of civil defence, or of taking air raid precautions, was to train civilians to protect themselves, their property, and their community during war. Men too old or unfit to fight volunteered for the Home Guard as air raid wardens or as gas decontamination specialists. Taxi drivers signed up to the auxiliary fire service. Teenagers became bicycle messengers. It was estimated that more than 1 million volunteers would be needed.
Among them was Nigerian-born Ita Ekpenyon. He'd been a teacher before moving to London 10 years previously to study law. And here, at the Westminster Archives, are his memoirs of his wartime experience. The people of the world are divided into two camps. One camp trying to enslave the world, the other camp
fighting to have peace and freedom in the world. In this struggle, civil defense is very important. So, my training as an air raid warden began in September 1939. It made me able to do my share for the British Commonwealth of Nations, to which I belong.
A third of civil defence volunteers were women. Many became ambulance drivers, or, like Frances, had just a week's training to become an auxiliary nurse. One in six ARP wardens were women, among them an out-of-work theatre actress from Islington called Barbara Nixon.
I joined the warden service because it seemed to me to be the most active and obviously helpful civil defence occupation open to women. My own work had closed down on the eve of the war. I wanted an active job.
She's smiling in her new overalls.
Civil defence training exercises took place all over the country and were probably quite good fun.
Here we were in Chelsea having a full-scale exercise in our little borough. Mrs. Freeth, my housekeeper, and I had both been given parts to play. My leg, broken in two places, was strapped. My wounds were bandaged with many giggles and much chafing. And I was taken in charge to wait an imaginary ambulance.
Newspapers being checked as they roll off the press.
In 1939, rolling news took the form of newspapers, radio, and newsreels shown in cinemas. Managing the news and preparing civil defence volunteers and the rest of the population for attack gave the government an unprecedented challenge. It was clear that this war would be fought not just with weapons, but also with information. So the government set up a new ministry here at Senate House in Bloomsbury. It was the Ministry of Information. The ministry employed 1,000 staff to issue national propaganda, to control the flow of all news and information relating to the war, and crucially, to prevent panic. They distributed training manuals for civil defence and information leaflets for the general public, much of it focused on the thing people feared most.
Nose irritant gas, lung irritant gas, blister gas. Terrifying. There were lots of official publications issued to members of the public, like this one. Air Raid Precautions Handbook Number 1, Personal Protection Against Gas. It suggests that you make a sealed refuge room in your house, and any bits and pieces you might need for your gas-protected room can be got, according to this advert here, from Boots the Chemists. And this fantastic thing is a little smelling set to train people to identify different types of poisonous gas. Here they all are. Who knew there were so many of them? Here's a sample of the smell of mustard gas. And this one here at the end is deadly lewisite, which apparently smells of geraniums. And this is to demonstrate the sort of blister that would appear on your skin if you came into contact with mustard gas. Now, if all this didn't give you nightmares, nothing would.
We were given lectures on the smells and effects of the different gases. We were told of the various standards of shelter protection. We were taught three ways of dealing with the small incendiary bomb. And we were told that the blast from a high explosive travels like sound in all directions and has an outward and a suction wave.
Barbara looks confused, then wardens in protective suits.
The government was so sure the Germans would drop poison gas on British people that air raid wardens were issued with full personal protective equipment. And by the time war was declared in September 1939, 38 million gas masks had been issued to the entire population.
Now, the minutes of the Committee of Imperial Defence tell us that the gas masks weren't just issued for physical protection, they were also supposed to make people feel better. They were issued for the sake of mass psychology and to avoid general panic that might decide the fate of the war. Your gas mask was supposed to be good for your morale.
A woman carrying folders enters a room marked Publicity.
To get the public ready and to rally morale, the publicity division of the Ministry of Information devised a propaganda campaign.
These posters were signed off by the Home Secretary in August 1939. These two were issued immediately, but they kept this one back. They were going to issue it later on when morale needed a boost after the destruction had actually started. It's so familiar, isn't it? It's the best-known wartime slogan. And I think it's right at the heart of what we understand about this chapter in our history. Keeping calm and carrying on seems like the essence of Blitz spirit. It must have captured the public mood, mustn't it?
The government certainly hoped so. Now war had been declared. The whole nation braced itself for the bombing to begin.
The warning may be short. Prepare now. Official information and instruction will be given over the wireless and in the newspapers.
In a matter of days, 1 million children were evacuated. 400 million sandbags were piled up. 86,000 handheld fire extinguishers called stirrup pumps were distributed. Patients were discharged from hospitals to make way for casualties and the millions of predicted cases of hysteria. Papier-mâché coffins were mass-produced for the huge number of expected dead.
If you are provided with a steel shelter and have not erected it, do so at once.
The most important preparation of all was to provide people with shelter from the bombs. Tin self-assembly Anderson shelters were given out. Basements of existing buildings converted, and brick surface shelters built on streets. But to keep transport running smoothly, the government rejected the idea of allowing people to shelter in underground stations.
When you hear these warning sirens, take cover at once. Put on your gas mask and keep it on.
In the first terrifying weeks after war was declared, there were frequent false alarms. People expected bombs at any moment. Would they keep calm and carry on? As Nina recorded in her diary, there were signs they might not. She was working in her parents' shop, where she observed,
"What sounds like an awful lot of panic buying. I served in my father's shop all day. Every third person asked for candles or nightlights.
Every fourth for sugar. Every sixth for black paper. We soon sold out of all these things, as did every other shop in Romford. And it became clear that people were wandering from shop to shop, getting a pound of sugar here, a pound there, a candle here, a nightlight there, and as cheaply as they could."
Children holding cats and dogs.
At the outbreak of war, London was home to 1.5 million cats and 500,000 dogs. They'd also suffer when the bombing began.
Official advice was issued about what should happen to your pets. It was repeated in the newspapers. It says here that if you and your family have to leave your home at short notice, and if your neighbours can't look after your pets, it really is kindest to have them destroyed. And this little book, Air Raid Precautions for Animals, suggests how you might best do that. There's an advert just here for a bolt pistol, which is the speediest and most efficient means of destroying any animal, including cats and all sizes of dogs. Tragically, in just that one first week after the declaration of war, 750,000 pets were put down.
Grainy footage of a little girl chasing her dog around a garden.
Now, this idea that we became a nation of pet killers doesn't really tally with our usual image of the British in the Blitz. But what I think it does show is that people were really, truly scared. And if the one thing the government truly feared was mass panic, then the slaughter of the pets was a warning sign.
People gathered on a pavement.
The government realised they needed to keep a close watch on the public mood. So the Ministry of Information set up a Home Intelligence Division, which would produce daily reports on morale.
You could say that this is the first time the government had taken the trouble to discover and to analyse public opinion.
Home Intelligence enlisted the help of an organisation called Mass Observation, a left-wing social research project that invited ordinary people to keep diaries of their wartime experiences and observations. 500 people signed up. Among them, 17-year-old Nina.
I came across an appeal for volunteers to join the Mass Observation Panel. I can't recall now the lofty line of thought which made me offer my youthful services to MO.
Nina made an immediate impression and persuaded them to give her a full-time paid job. She moved out of her parents' house to Diggs in Stepney, East London.
Mixing with all those bohemians and writing folk, my parents warned me, would be my ruin. But I was thrilled to bits. We had all kinds of rather ingenious ways of assessing morale. Like, for example, counting how many people had gas masks, or how many people we saw in the pubs.
From all these sources, I put together reports in what Londoners were thinking about the war.
Nina puts a sheet of paper in her typewriter.
6 months after war was declared, in April 1940, Germany invaded Norway and Denmark. But in Britain, war was still something people only read about. The force of invasion was so remote that almost a million of the children who'd been evacuated were brought by their families back to the city. Only 1% of people were still carrying their gas masks. It became known as the phony war. Home Intelligence commissioned a survey to find out how well the morale-boosting Red Poster campaign was working.
Mass observation reports revealed that people found these posters patronising. Your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution will bring us victory. Seemed like a message from an out-of-touch ruling class who were expecting the working classes to sacrifice themselves in a way that some people thought that they'd done in the First World War. Now, given that the expected destruction hadn't yet materialised, and given that this whole campaign was deemed a failure, early in 1940, this poster, Keep Calm and Carry On, got pulped. All 2.4 million copies of it.
Well, almost all. One showed up in a bookshop in the year 2000, and the rest is history.
And this is the perfect case in point. Something we associate so strongly with Britain in wartime turns out to have fairly tangential relationship to reality. It's a myth.
The Imperial War Museum holds a vast archive of World War II memoirs and diaries. They reveal the shift in the public mood from anxiety to apathy during the phony war.
This is the moment that long-serving fireman Frank Hurd begins his wartime diary. As soon as the warning went, we were required to rig ourselves in full fire gear
with respirator at the alert and to stay rigged until the all-clear sounded. So we were getting a bit fed up with this sort of thing. And I think a few of us, I hoped for something to happen. And then felt ashamed for letting the monotony get us down.
The public was already grumbling that the full-time civil defence personnel was a waste of money. A set of slackers after easy jobs. Raids at some time, however, were a certainty.
A printing press churns out newspapers, which are then loaded into a van.
On the 10th of May 1940, the Germans were on the march again. They invaded Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg, and on the very same day, Winston Churchill became Prime Minister.
Churchill set about renewing the nation's readiness for war.
We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall never surrender.
2 weeks later, the Germans advanced rapidly across the border into France, surrounding Allied troops. 338,000 of them were miraculously rescued from the beaches at Dunkirk. Then France, too, surrendered. It seemed inevitable that Britain would be next.
A young man wearing overalls and an armband.
17-year-old Robert Bulltrop was working as a porter in a Sainsbury's warehouse when he heard the news.
Somebody came into the warehouse and almost with satisfaction rubbed his hands together and said, "Well, we're on our own now." For all of us, there was a feeling of danger for the first time, unlike the panickiness of 3rd of September 1939. The idea of the Germans invading Britain was in the air.
Archive footage of German planes flying in formation.
To pave the way for invasion, Hitler first needed air superiority.
Pilots scramble to their planes.
In July 1940, his Luftwaffe took on the RAF in an aerial fight. The Battle of Britain. The Germans dropped bombs on British shipping convoys and strategic sites along the coast. For many British people, this was their first glimpse of the planes they'd feared for so long. The government was paranoid that Nazi spies were already landing in Britain, aided by an enemy within. 27,000 Italians, Germans, and Austrians, whether British residents or refugees, were arrested. 80% of them were Jewish. They were imprisoned in internment camps, like this one in Liverpool. The Ministry of Information launched a campaign encouraging people to be suspicious of their neighbours.
The Blitz is often held up as this time of great national unity. Everybody pulling together, everybody doing their bit. But clearly the reality was much messier. I think that at the moment Britain faced this terrible test, there was genuinely some confusion about what it meant to be British, what values you should uphold. In times of crisis, we always get a new perspective on ourselves. When events start to unfold beyond our control, when it really matters, the question is, who will we be?
Factory chimneys belching smoke by the river.
In August 1940, a lone German bomber dropped bombs on Harrow, a suburb of London. In retaliation, Churchill ordered the bombing of Berlin, and Hitler was furious. What Londoners didn't know was that this was the moment he decided they were now a target. Hitler determined to bring Britain to its knees, to attack its political and economic heart, to stir class division and to crush the morale of the people. It had been exactly a year since Britain declared war on Germany.
Finally, on the 7th of September 1940, all the predictions, all the planning, all the recruitment, all the training, all the resolve of the entire population would be put to the most extraordinary test.
Colour footage of London buses, then people enjoying a park. Barbara.
7th of September was one of those beautiful early autumn days that feel like spring. There was hardly a wisp of cloud in the pale blue sky.
Cheers, Bill.
That's all right.
Frank takes a cup of tea.
At 4:43 p.m, the sirens wailed and the population trooped to the shelters.
Here we go again.
But nobody was seriously frightened. There had been repeated alerts and a few actual bombs dropped during the preceding weeks. Something might possibly happen this time, but probably not.
Robert had volunteered to be a fire watcher. That afternoon, he was taking his turn up on the supermarket warehouse roof.
It wasn't bad during these daytime warnings, sitting up there in the sunshine, smoking and watching the sky, looking down below at people just going on as usual.
Robert turns and sees waves of German planes approaching.
And I sat there and on the skyline, coming in along the Thames like a swarm of flies. And I saw and heard the anti-aircraft fire all around them, the puffs of smoke and the thumping. And the swarm of flies weaving its way through it.
A large V-shaped formation of planes flew over us heading to the southeast. The tiny machines glinted in the sunlight and looked more like a flock of geese migrating before winter than hostile aircraft.
I watched them flying along. I began to hear thumps, and those were bombs falling. And still, they were coming. And it was going to be the docks that were going to get it.
Robert Albert grabs his helmet and sets off, while overhead, the German planes continue unabated.
In 1940, the docks of London's East End went all the way from London Bridge, 9 miles along the river, to Woolwich. This whole area was a major hub of transport and industry.
Wharves, railway lines, power stations, and vast warehouses full of materials essential to Britain's ability to fight a war. But they were also home to dock workers and their families. Some 200,000 people lived in Stepney alone. The river, lifeblood of London, would now provide a clear path to guide in 965 German planes. As they reached the docks, the bombers began to drop hundreds of 18-inch incendiary bombs, containing a magnesium mixture which ignited on impact and burnt at a very high temperature.
Incendiary bombs were very carefully designed to start fires. And start fires they did.
My training was tested when London was heavily bombed, and I found that it had not been in vain. My first incident was to put out an incendiary bomb with a stirrup pump. I knew exactly how to approach the bomb and the fire caused by it without exposing myself to danger.
But stirrup pumps would be no match for the fires they faced.
Terror writ large on his face, Eater drops his hose as he stares at the orange flames engulfing the city.
By 6 p.m., there were more than 40 separate fires in the East End, burning out of control. The enormous blazes were captured by the fire brigade's own film unit. Huge warehouses and factories on both sides of the river went up in flames. 4 miles away in North London, Air Raid Warden Barbara was waiting to be called in.
That afternoon, the danger was still remote from us. Most wardens waited in a mixture of dread, expectation, and impatience, wondering whether the civil defence plans would really work and how they themselves would react.
Footage of ferocious flames lapping the roof of a building.
The fire brigade was utterly overwhelmed. At Surrey Docks, 300 pumps and 1,000 men were fighting to contain just one of the fires. Crews from as far away as Birmingham and Bristol and from all over London were called to help.
We all guessed it must be something unusual to send us from Euston on a journey that long. As soon as we entered the East End, we saw evidence of the raids, the first most of us had seen. Houses were demolished, roads torn up, and a surface shelter was wrecked. Ambulance rescue squads were at work as we passed.
Firemen haul a hose into position, then Frank turns on the water.
My unit was sent to Beckton Gasworks. Chaos met our eyes.
The scene is an inferno.
The raid lasted 90 minutes, and the fires could be seen from 30 miles away.
The dock is awash with orange flames.
At 10 past six, the planes went back down the River Thames, leaving behind them nothing but flames.
Out there, with nothing to do except watch the hose, we had the time to look round. What a sight.
Embers fall like snow around Frank.
About a mile to our right was the riverfront. The whole horizon on that side was a sheet of flame. And on all other sides, it was much the same. Fires everywhere.
Frank burns his finger on an ember. Then Francis approaches Richard.
I've been called in.
Richard gets to his feet, kisses and hugs Francis, then watches with a concerned expression as she heads off in her nurse's uniform.
As the all clear sounded, auxiliary nurse Francis wasn't the only one going out into the chaos for the first time. 17-year-old Nina had been in her local Stepney shelter and wrote in her mass observation diary what she saw when she stepped outside.
Every street was damaged. Smoke and flame streaming from the docks. Bombs everywhere.
Nina signals to Francis that a woman needs help.
Shouting. Finding relatives. Chaos.
On the streets, a young woman looks panicked, then a man rushes to a collapsed building. Robert arrives on the scene. He stops and watches for a moment before hurrying off. The young woman turns to see Robert running towards her, opens her arms and embraces him. Gripping her for dear life, Robert buries his face in her long black hair.
She turned up. Sounds daft, but perhaps we thought it was a bit romantic to meet in an air raid. All this was going on very close to us. We could smell the smoke and hear the bombs.
When the all-clear sounded at 6:15, people left the shelters saying, oh, about time too. I had not immediately grasped the principle that an important part of the incendiary raids was to provide a beacon for the later bombings.
I'm sorry, wasn't it? You're in one piece.
Yeah, just...
At 8:10, a second wave of planes came up the Thames. Those fires in East London had been started to guide in these 318 bombers, carrying with them 300 tons of high explosive bombs and landmines. The onslaught was about to begin again. A 500-kilo high explosive bomb would take out two houses in a terrace. A 1,000-kilo parachute bomb could destroy a whole street. This was what rained down onto ordinary Londoners. Bombs so powerful that even at a distance they could kill you by sucking the air out of your lungs.
Barbara runs for cover. Francis.
Again and again they return to drop more and more bombs into the inferno.
A weird whistling sound. I ducked beside the pump together with two more of the crew. The others, as scattered as we were, had thrown themselves down wherever they happened to be. Then the vivid flash of flame. Column of earth and debris flying into the air, and the ground heaved. I was thrown violently against the side of the appliance.
12,000 reported on the run to the West End. Everyone asking, where shall we go? Where can we go?
Again and again, and we heard the whoosh of a bomb.
Building fell on a group of men and women. Screams, groans.
Rome shuddered with the explosions.
A sudden rush back of the people followed immediately by a rush forward.
AA shells were bursting overhead. Shrapnel literally rained down.
The area of glowing red-orange light was so fast.
Women fainted. Mass hysteria, man threw a fit.
By 10 p.m, the shelterers were growing exasperated.
Men, women and children crying and sobbing.
By midnight, they were very frightened.
It was now about midnight and still this incessant
frantic parents searching for their young, dead and dying on the pavements.
We should all live underground.
Someone sick.
And every time there was a thump, a mother screamed.
Nearly every street had a house in flames. Fire engines
people
rushing everywhere.
My house is burning. Call the fire brigade. What shall we do?
Roads blocked, streets in ruin, named places that I knew.
By 3 a.m, the raid was heavier than ever, and the bombs were much
bombs
closer.
Flying everywhere.
They came down with a tearing sound.
It gave us a horrible feeling of impotence in the face of its magnitude.
We crouched in doorways, thinking, the next one must get us.
A figure silhouetted against an amber glow, then flames licking a church spire.
At 4:30 a.m, after 8 hours, the bombing finally stopped.
The waterfront shrouded in thick grey smoke.
I went home. When they heard me come in, my father came down and made a cup of tea. We sat there, and how grievingly he talked about the East End and the people in it and what they must be suffering. And then we went to bed. And should we wake up in the morning? What would tomorrow be like?
Smoke drifts across piles of brick, stone and twisted metal in the pale ghostly light of morning. The skeletal frames of buildings pepper the apocalyptic landscape. Firemen atop a mound of debris battle with picks and shovels to find survivors. A woman is helped through the rubble, then a body is stretchered away.
430 dead. Hundreds more injured. People trapped in the wreckage of their own homes.
But on the morning of Sunday, the 8th of September, the Sunday Express had this to say: there is no reason whatsoever for dejection or depression. The RAF is more than holding its own. The government had imposed strict rules on what you could and couldn't report about an air raid. If your only source of news in September 1940 was the papers, then you'd have no idea at all about the emergency unfolding in the East End of London.
A young female victim lying between piles of rubble is covered with a sheet by two civil defence volunteers.
After a devastating night, civil defence volunteers continued the desperate search for survivors.
A boy in a long coat surveys the destruction, then the body of a woman lying among the twisted remnants of a bomb shelter.
It's no good. So one of us is going to have to go down.
After her night shift at the hospital, Frances walks home through the ruined streets.
Passing a gap in a terrace, I saw a little group of people bending over what seemed to be a hole in what had been the basement of a house.
Nurse! Nurse! Help.
Frances is helped onto the rubble pile.
I could hear voices now. Someone was in mortal anguish down there. It was horrible. It was like an animal caught in a trap.
Eyes closed, she shakes her head.
Oh, God, I thought. Let them be quick and get them out, or let them die quickly.
We need somebody to go down. Somebody down there, OK?
Take off your coat, said the doctor. And your dress, he said. It's too dangerous. The folds may catch in the debris and bring the whole thing down. It will have to be the chloroform, he said. Hold it to the face. Try to keep yourself from inhaling it. Be as quick as you can.
Wearing just her petticoat, Frances is lowered into the hole head first by the doctor and another man.
The torch showed me that the chest of the man trapped there was crushed. His face was so injured that you could not tell the mouth from the rest of it. It just seemed one great, gaping, red mess. I took the torch cautiously from between my teeth and began trying to soothe the remains of what had once been a man. I held the pad firmly over him. Breathe deeply. 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 There was a small convulsive movement of revulsion. Another fainter one. And then the sound stopped. All was quiet.
Out of the hole, Frances starts to cry.
You're all right. You're safe. Thank you so much.
There were other bodies down there.
She bites her bottom lip, then closes her eyes.
I'd see the pieces.
Frances puts on a shirt, then her coat, before the doctor helps her over the rubble. Back on the street, she stops in her tracks, clutches her stomach, then throws up.
All I wanted was to get away. All the way back to Chelsea, I vomited at intervals.
Frances wells up, then looks down with a furrowed brow. She takes the blood-stained hem of her skirt in her hands. Robert.
450 or more people have been killed in East London. A huge number injured, terrible destruction carried on. And they were coming back that night.
People crossing a bridge, then social distancing signs at a railway station.
As a second night of bombing approached, people were desperate to find somewhere safe to shelter. Some headed for underground stations, but the government had banned their use and locked the gates.
On the afternoon of September the 8th, a great crowd of people gathered here outside the guarded gates of Liverpool Street Underground Station. The station staff called in soldiers to help keep the people out, but the crowd kept on growing and getting angrier. Eventually, though, sheer force of numbers meant that they had to open the gates. The people came surging in. They went rushing down to the platform, ready to fight for the space to shelter for the night. This is not what we expect from Blitz Spirit. People driven by desperation, willing to break the law to find safe shelter underground.
A policeman whistles as he runs.
Above them, the bombers were returning, and scores of volunteers were heading out onto the streets.
An explosion sent a plume of debris and smoke into the air. A man runs, then jumps through ruins.
Air raid warden Barbara was on duty, checking on the shelters in her North London patch.
Suddenly, the shabby five-story building ahead of me swelled out like a child's balloon. Almost instantaneously, there was a crash and a double explosion in the street to my right. I was mildly surprised to find that I was not hurt in the least.
Barbara looks up and watches as her victim's carried away on a stretcher, the corpse's long brown hair hanging from beneath a blanket.
Now I would know whether I was going to be of any use as a warden or not. And I was not let down lightly.
Barbara's wandering through the thick smoke, holding a hand over her chest. She stops and peers down at the ground. Breathing heavily, she looks up, then turns around with fear and confusion etched in her face. She returns her focus to the ground, then slowly crouches down with arms outstretched.
In the middle of the street lay the remains of a baby. It had been blown clean through the window and had burst, striking the roadway. To my intense relief, as pitiful and horrible as it was, I was not nauseated. I found a torn piece of curtain in which to wrap it.
She holds her head in her hand, then wipes her face. Now back standing in the street, Barbara cradles the baby. She looks around with despairing eyes. Now back home, Barbara pulls her overalls down to the waist, then bows her head.
That day, London had changed. It was like a drunk man suddenly sobering up when he receives tragic news. At last, people realized there was a serious war on. A war that meant visible death and destruction. Not only newspaper articles and recruiting posters and war memorials. And they did not like that realization.
People walking down a modern-day London street in torrential rain. Luce is approaching the entrance to a grand building whose stone facade is riddled with scars.
Once the Blitz had started, war, for ordinary people, was no longer hypothetical. This was the new reality. Terrifying bombs falling night after night. But it soon became the new normal.
And if you look closely, like here on the walls of the Victoria and Albert Museum, London still bears the scars.
Footage of a volunteer riding a bike with a take cover sign around his neck.
For civil defence volunteers, the new normal meant a regular job by day and then a shift on this new front line by night.
A house crumbles to the ground.
Air raid wardens were usually the first on the scene after a bombing raid. Then came the fire brigade and the heavy rescue squad, who cut off gas and water supplies so anyone trapped under the wreckage wouldn't drown. The first aid party assessed the injured, tying parcel labels to them. X for internal injury, T for tourniquet, M for morphine. The stretcher party would transfer them to the nearest first aid post. In the first few weeks of September 1940, bombing raids came every single night. They were soon taking their toll.
A worn-out fireman.
Every night for the past week, God only knew for how many weeks to come, we'd been out tackling fires started by enemy action. It was really heartbreaking. No sooner would a fire be got under than it would be hit and start again, or else one would be started next door to it. Yeah, I know what it is to feel really tired nowadays.
In East London, Nina was now sending daily reports to mass observation of what she was witnessing in Stepney.
Faces this morning were grim and tired. There is a lot of talk about casualties. How many? Who? Anyone I know? There is also a lot of bewilderment and a kind of hopelessness about shelters.
Nina looks up and sighs, then a grey stone facade of a towering Art Deco building.
Meanwhile, at the Ministry of Information, the Department of Home Intelligence were producing reports on what all this was doing to morale. It became apparent that some brick surface shelters had been shoddily constructed and were prone to collapsing fatally on their inhabitants.
A woman brings Lucy a file.
As the morale reports tell us, people were increasingly reluctant to use the surface shelters. Here we go. Continued belief in many districts that public surface shelters are not safe and people use tube stations instead. Last night, the tubes are reported to have been as crowded as ever. The War Cabinet looked again at this question of whether or not people should shelter in the tube, and their minutes show that they decided not. It was more important, they agreed, to keep the tubes available for transport services. So they put an appeal into the papers, sheltering in tubes. Please don't do it. It says here, refrain from using tube stations as air raid shelters except in the case of urgent necessity. Now, I don't think that you'd want to use a tube station as a shelter except in a case of urgent necessity. They were super crowded down there and conditions were deteriorating fast. By the end of September, 200,000 Londoners each night were buying tickets, not to travel, but so they could shelter on the platforms. EastEnders with nowhere else to go also occupied other buildings. None of these unofficial shelters had any facilities. The enormous Tilbury shelter, underneath a railway warehouse, was on Nina's East End patch. It was regularly occupied by 10,000 people, and she reported on it for mass observation.
The first impression was of a dim, cavernous immensity.
Nina walks past two men in the near darkness.
The hall is oblong in shape and covers many acres. So huge and dim, the end seems out of sight. You just couldn't see anything. You could just smell the fog. The overwhelming stench. There were thousands and thousands of people lying head to toe all along the bays and with no facilities. There were just four earth buckets down the far end behind screens for toilets. The place was a hellhole.
The conditions EastEnders were enduring and the sheer scale of the bombing raids were barely mentioned in the press. The government imposed a 28-day rule. Locations of bombing raids and casualty numbers couldn't be reported until 4 weeks after an attack. Newspapers were monitored by the aptly named scrutineers here at the Ministry of Information.
Photos for the newspapers had to get past the censors as well. In this picture, the censors taken the red pen to all this side because that would have revealed that the raid was in Leicester Square. If you included a picture of a bombed building, you also had to include a building that was still standing.
It was all done with good intentions.
But in fact, the failure publicly to acknowledge the suffering that was going on in East London was doing more harm than good.
The press and BBC versions of morale reaction in the East End are much more misleading, and in some cases bear no relation whatever to the reality. There was no bread, no milk, no electricity, no gas, no telephones. As usual, the press proclaimed the public were unshaken, marvellous, etc., etc.
On a 38 bus in Piccadilly, a wretched-looking woman with two children got in and sat down next to me. They still had blast dust in their hair and they were utterly miserable. And the lady opposite moved seats and said loudly that people like that should not be allowed on buses.
If Hitler's intent in bombing London had been to fuel class division and catastrophically damage morale, I think it was starting to look like that plan was working.
Morale report, 10th of September, 1940. Class feeling growing because of worse destruction in working class areas. Many shelters in districts too badly damaged for use. All this has led to talk today of marching to the West End to commandeer hotels.
Bomb shelters for the well-to-do up west couldn't have been more different. In certain hotels, you could book dinner and a bed in the basement.
In late September, as many as 100 EastEnders converged upon the Savoy. They whipped out banners they'd hidden under their coats, calling for access to the tube and better conditions for people who were less well off. At a time of so-called national unity, class divisions were more apparent than ever.
Angry shelter users and wardens like Barbara had once again to take matters into their own hands.
In our area, we suggested to the shelterers that they and we should club together and buy disinfectant sprays. In the larger underground stations, sheer force of numbers and the leadership of a few stalwarts compelled the provision of lavatories.
In one shelter, a local optician called Mickey Davis took charge. He enlisted the help of a wealthy socialite who persuaded Marks and Spencers to fund a communal meal service. The government adopted the model. Before long, hundreds of canteens were providing 10,000 meals a day. They were first called citizens' kitchens, but Churchill said this sounded too communist and insisted they be called British restaurants instead. However well-intentioned, government preparations for aerial bombing had fallen short. Gas attacks hadn't materialised, and 38 million gas masks remained unused. Shelters were too few and ill-equipped, and it was ordinary people who took the lead to put things right.
This is the most remarkable paper trail. It's a mass observation report about conditions in the Tilbury shelter by an East End working girl. That's our Nina. The place is so filthy and decrepit that when you get over the shock of seeing so many sprawling people...
You are overcome with the smell of humanity and dirt. People are sleeping on piles of rubbish. Dirt abounds everywhere. There's no escaping it.
Now, Nina's words were quoted very extensively in an article in the New Statesman, when you get over the shock of seeing so many people, etc., etc. And we know that this article was read by the Prime Minister, because the minutes of the War Cabinet tell us that, having read the article, the Prime Minister urged the need for strong action to prevent large numbers of people crowding into this building until the necessary work had been done to make it safe. Isn't that cool? The testimony of 17-year-old Nina from the East End is influencing government policy.
Within days, work began to improve conditions at the Tilbury shelter. The War Cabinet then reviewed their position on underground stations.
On the 25th of September, the government announced its U-turn in the press. From now on, the use of tube stations as shelters would officially be recognised. In fact, the little branch line that went to this particular station in the Strand was closed off to trains altogether. The station would be given over entirely to members of the public to use as a shelter.
Soon, 79 other tube stations became official shelters, better equipped with toilets and bunks, which made the long nights underground more tolerable. But despite this government U-turn, there was another crisis brewing. In the first 6 weeks of the Blitz, of the 250,000 Londoners who'd been made homeless by the bombs, only 7,000 had been rehoused.
People who'd lost their houses had nowhere to sleep, nowhere to wash, nowhere to eat, no clothes, no money, no ration book, and no idea what to do about any of this.
Within weeks, rest centres, set up to offer temporary respite to bombed-out Londoners, were overflowing with tens of thousands of people.
The government delegated the problem of homelessness to the peacetime agencies, but they were much more used to dealing with people made homeless through poverty, not through bombing. And these agencies also harboured really old prejudices against the poor.
The public assistance officials could not rid themselves of the idea that they were dispensing charity. And it was this attitude that caused even more resentment and anger than the delays. It was seldom a man's own fault that he was out of work. Still less was it his fault that a Nazi bomb had demolished his home and destroyed all his possessions and means of living.
I was sitting in the kitchen when a bomb fell, the house collapsed, I lost all my clothes and money.
Once again, it was ordinary people and voluntary organisations who stepped in.
I hope you will like this house. It'll fix you up for the moment, anyway.
The Citizens Advice Bureau provided information about where to find help. The Women's Voluntary Service provided hundreds of mobile canteens. The Red Cross, St. John's Ambulance, the Salvation Army all provided first aid, blankets and clothes to the many thousands left destitute by the bombs.
What all this tells us, I think, is that when the chips were down, people stepped up. They didn't fall prey to mass panic. They didn't morally collapse. But if this sense of resourcefulness and resilience is what we call Blitz spirit, I think we should remember it was born entirely of necessity.
A church tower dwarfed by a skyscraper.
In October 1940, after 5 weeks of relentless bombing, two disasters shocked London. On the 13th, a nearby bomb strike caused the tunnel to collapse at Bounds Green Tube Station, killing 19 people. As these remarkable photos show, the very next night, a bomb strike above Balham Tube Station burst a water main, flooding the tunnel with water and soil. 66 people drowned. The fact was, nowhere was truly safe. And who lived and who died turned on the flip of a coin.
This little thing is a marvellous illustration of the vagaries of fate. It's a cigarette lighter, which belonged to an ARP warden called George Hutchins. He had it in his breast pocket during a raid one night. And that small, mundane fact saved his life. You can see that the shrapnel has gone through his lighter and not through his heart. That such a tiny, everyday decision, whether or not to take your lighter, whether to go left or right down the street, had life or death consequences, must have been very hard to get your head around.
People found their own ways to keep such profound uncertainty at arm's length.
Oh, listen here. Capricorn, don't pay attention to rumours.
More column inches than ever were dedicated to horoscopes. Some carried lucky charms or developed their own superstitions, as air raid warden Eater experienced.
It amuses me to know that in the districts where I work, the people believe that because I am a man of colour, I am a lucky omen. I had heard of such childlike beliefs, but I am delighted that such beliefs exist. For wherever I go, people listen to my instructions and are willing to allow me to lead them.
Some told stories about their brushes with fate, or resigned themselves to uncertainty.
I'm 75 years of age and I think I'm a fatalist. For I think if my name had been on that bomb, I should have been killed with it. But as it is, I'm still kept merry and bright and full of beans, thumbs up.
Bob's your uncle.
Oh, Bob's my uncle, thumbs up.
The bomb, and everyone's special bomb, was still a source of endless interest and possibilities. They were coming so thick and fast that everyone had a better story than his neighbour.
But
I had absolute conviction that my number would be on one of those bombs. Richard's reassurances that the chances were one in a million made no difference. I just knew it.
While fear bound some people together,
where is my petrol, you bastard?
The forced proximity of bomb shelters also brought long-standing divisions to the fore and a rather different Blitz spirit.
This guy is crazy.
The bombing of London forced a mixed crowd to be in one another's company, though their ways and manners and views of life in some cases were as opposite as the North and South Poles.
He never paid me!
Some of the shelterers told the others to go back to their own country. And some tried to practice segregation.
Anti-Semitism has increased markedly. To a remarkable extent, Jews and Cockneys live in the same area and in the same streets without mixing socially. But air raids have forced them into proximity, especially in the communal shelters. Under the trying conditions, underlying antagonisms have been fanned into flames.
I told people that the British Empire, which is also known as the British Commonwealth of Nations, is made up of people of many races. Then I spoke of three classes in the shelter: His Majesty's subjects, protected persons, and guests. These last were refugees from other countries. I said that this being the case, I would like to see a spirit of friendliness, cooperation, and comradeship prevail in this very trying time in the history of the Empire. I further warned my audience that if what I had said was not going to be practiced, I would advise those who did not agree to seek shelter somewhere else.
So it sometimes seems like the Blitz did as much to push people apart as it did to bring them together. But we tend to think about the past in a series of neat little images that cover up that complexity. For example, this image, perhaps the most famous of all, the cheerful milkman delivering the milk through the ruins. He's the quintessential plucky Londoner. I think there's no single story here. The Blitz was both division and unity. It was fear, but also resilience. It was falling apart, and it was carrying on. But there's something else here that is so interesting to me. This famous picture is not what it seems, because that's not a real milkman. The photographer borrowed the bottles and the milkman's coat, and he got his assistant to pose. So even at the time, Blitz spirit wasn't just being observed, it was also being contrived.
A newsreel showing St. Paul's Cathedral and bearing the slogan, "London can take it."
London raises her head, shakes the debris of the night from her hair, and takes stock of the damage done.
In October 1940, the Ministry of Information made a film to be shown in America. It was also screened in Britain, that epitomized the version of the Blitz the government wanted people to see.
The nightly air raids have had a terrific effect upon the morale of the people of London. Today, the morale of the people is higher than ever before.
"London can take it," meant the East End and the people in the East End accepted this to some extent. They knew they were taking the brunt of it, and lots of other people weren't seeing a great deal of brunt.
But a bomb has its limitations. It can only destroy buildings and kill people. It cannot kill the unconquerable spirit and courage of the people of London. London can take it.
Let no one think that press phrases about taking it or much-loved Cockney jokes while bricks and mortar crashed to rubble, that there were not many who groaned every time we raided Germany in dread of the retaliation they would get.
The film showed how the truth was being manipulated for propaganda and how the myth of Blitz spirit was taking shape. By November, Nina was fed up with the way mass observation research was being misused by the ministry, including her report about people's distrust of surface shelters.
To Nina's utter dismay, her report about the terrible conditions in surface shelters was used by the Ministry of Information, but not to argue for their improvement. Instead, the ministry used it to finesse a leaflet reassuring people that surface shelters were absolutely fine.
I was shocked to the core. I was well aware that the value of the information depended on which political force was using it. And until that moment, I'd stuck to my belief that Emo's heart was broadly in the right place. But I hadn't come to grips with its changed function under the Ministry of Information. I was terribly ashamed by the part I had unwittingly played in this act of betrayal. I left soon afterwards in a blaze of indignation and fury.
Night raids over Britain have lately increased.
Birmingham has been one of the enemy's targets. Damage was done and lives lost.
By mid-November 1940, German tactics changed, and other British cities were targeted too. Birmingham, Cardiff, Manchester, Liverpool, Bristol, Sheffield, Southampton. The people of Coventry buried more than 500 of their dead in mass graves. But even amid the nationwide destruction, the myth of Blitz spirit had taken root.
And despite the worst time Manchester has experienced since the outbreak of war, the people's chins are up and protruding a little more than usual. Manchester can take it.
Archive footage shows women and children gathered together, smiling for the camera. Children decorate a Christmas tree on a packed underground platform.
By Christmas 1940, after 4 months of bombing, 22,000 British people had been killed. The British government heard, via Washington, that Germany intended to suspend attacks over Christmas.
We formed a committee of shelterers and agreed to have a party on Christmas Day. When this was made known, the shelterers worked together and decorated the four rooms of the shelter, much to the admiration of visitors.
We had a marvellous party there. Underground, everybody who could be raked in, standing around the piano, singing and party games. There was this feeling of, let's have a good time.
At Christmas, when the raids were lighter, the old lady in the newspaper shop asked me if I thought it was now safe for her to undress. She hadn't, she said, had her clothes off since September.
Barbara's smile quickly fades. Looking over trees to a city in the distance.
In this sudden lull in the bombing, there must have finally been a sense of hope for the future. Especially for Richard and Frances.
I'm pregnant.
Before the bombing started, people feared war from the air would bring civilization to an end. Terrible though it was, that hadn't happened. And people began to contemplate the kind of world they wanted to live in when the war was over. But it was not over yet.
At the fire station, Frank drinks from a mug, sets it aside, then grips a small medallion hanging from his neck.
On December the 29th, on the cusp of a new year, the silence was broken. This would be one of the heaviest nights of bombing of the Blitz.
A searchlight projects its beam into the pitch-black sky. Then the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral momentarily illuminated by a flash of light from an exploding bomb.
The Germans chose low tide to make it harder to get water from the river and dropped 100,000 incendiaries and high explosive bombs onto the city around St. Paul's Cathedral. Thousands of firefighters were called to tackle hundreds of fires in the city's square mile, but they struggled to bring the water to get the fires under control. Among them was a crew led by Frank.
Gritting his teeth, Frank's aiming the nozzle at an ornate building engulfed in flames, but no water's appearing.
We went up onto our flat roof, which was pretty high. Gave a splendid view over London.
Frances is staring into space.
It was awful. Although beautiful. Brilliant blood red. All I can think of were the words of the round. London's burning. London's burning. Fire, fire. Fire, fire. Fetch the water.
Fire crews battling blazes, a perilous ladder climb, then crumbling masonry.
Fetch the water. or all will be lost.
Frank's leading his crew. He tries to engage the hose, then looks up as a bomb whistles through the air towards them. Caught in the blast, debris covers Frank and his crew. Lucy's shadow leads the way as she walks down stone steps. She stops at a red brick wall.
9,000 firemen were called to fires in the city that night. 250 of those firemen were injured, and 16 of them were killed. And among them was Frank. He was fatally injured by a collapsing building here near Smithfield Market.
Lucy places a photo of Frank posing proudly in his uniform on a gate, then solemnly turns and walks away. A photo shows scores of volunteers hunched over as they dig through the ruins of a collapsed building.
Churches, factories, offices, pubs, homes, all destroyed. 163 civilians were killed and 500 injured. Fire watchers on the roof had fought desperately to protect it, making the great survivor of this terrible night St. Paul's Cathedral.
Lucy stares up at the cathedral, takes a seat on its steps, then unfolds a newspaper.
There is no photo more famous, more iconic than this one to capture the Blitz and Blitz spirit. It shows St. Paul's Cathedral standing unharmed in the midst of the burning city. Its propaganda value was obvious immediately. And in this case, the 28-day rule wasn't applied. Just 2 days later, it appeared on the front page of the Daily Mail, and it became this potent symbol of the indomitable spirit of the British. But, crucially, in the paper, the image has been cropped to minimise these bombed-out buildings in the foreground. And that, for me, is why this image really epitomises Blitz spirit. It is powerful, it is evocative, but it's also been edited, cropping out the more troubling, the more complex reality of what went on beneath the bombs.
A man in uniform carrying a small suitcase helps a woman along a bombed-out street.
After the devastating raids of December, the Blitz went on until May 1941. Then, having failed to force a British surrender, Hitler's attention shifted to the Soviet Union. The people of London and of other cities, from Cardiff to Hull, Belfast to Plymouth, had endured an unprecedented crisis. In total, the Blitz cost 44,652 people their lives.
A photo of volunteers carrying someone on a stretcher.
When we look back at this extraordinary chapter in our history, I think it's important to try to look beyond the clichés. Yes, there was remarkable resilience nationwide, but there was also terrible suffering. History is an inherently messy business. There's never just one version of events. And beyond the official version, I think we owe it to the people who were there to make the reality of their experience count. If there's one thing we can learn from the Blitz about a national crisis, it's how to value everyone. From the planners, to the frontline workers, to the volunteers. So next time you hear that phrase, Blitz spirit, you'll know what it really means.
That the ordinary people of London showed the stubborn fortitude they did for so long is something of a miracle. It showed even more clearly that life goes on under the most intense and fearful pressure, and that it is all but impossible to destroy the will to live.
Now heavily pregnant, Frances is welcomed by Richard as she arrives home. There's a flash of light as the house is struck by a bomb. Smoke and dust drift over the rubble. The outline of Francis's face appears in the darkness. Suddenly, her eyes open.
At last, it appeared to have stopped. I raised my head. I could see sky and searchlights. I knew the whole upper three stories of the house was gone. We've been hit, I said. One in a million.
Francis's faint smile fades. After the war, Nina became a film critic for the left-wing newspaper, The Daily Worker. An old woman with long curly red hair smiles as she looks at a photo of a woman and child. Nina's daughter, Sally Hibben. Barbara went into politics and became a London County Councillor. A book called Raiders Overhead by Barbara Nixon is opened to reveal a photo of the author in her uniform. Frank was 44 when he was killed. He had been a fireman for 20 years. His diary is one of 12,000 kept in the archives of the Imperial War Museum. Robert had many careers, from boxer to illustrator and writer. A grey-haired man looking upon a framed black-and-white photo of Robert. Robert's son, Chris Bartrop. Eater couldn't afford to finish his law degree. He worked as a postman until he died, aged 52. An elderly woman holding a photo of Eater dressed in his uniform. Eater's daughter, Oku Ekpenyon. Frances wrote a memoir of her experience during the Blitz and four novels. Sitting with one of Francis's novels in one hand and holding a strip of small photos in his other, Francis and Richard's son, John Parker.
If today your heart is weary, if every little thing looks gray, just forget your troubles and learn to say, tomorrow is a lie.